Chapter 26. When it seemed unlikely the creature would find us again, Glass quietened the motor and we resumed our progress with the oars. I had reloaded the harpoon gun with the one remaining barb, but after that encounter had seen nothing that merited raising the weapon. Which was not to say that we were relieved, or in any way confident. Although very little was said of the matter, what was there to say, since we had all seen the same thing? Each of us in our private fashion must have been mulling the creature's motives, and wondering if its intentions were as belligerent as they had seemed at the time. If we had surprised these creatures with our presence on Ararat, then perhaps they had been forced into actions which only looked to be hostile, because barriers of language precluded any reasoned persuasion. Maybe they had tried to net the boat, not because they meant harm to us, or our craft, but because, by the time they knew of us, we were moving too quickly to be dissuaded by other means. When that had failed, one had followed us into the node, and if the creature had meant to hurt us, then by the time he surprised us, we were in easy range of spears, arrows, poison darts, or any throwing weapon I cared to name. But the creature had asked us to stop, and when we had refused, it had only demonstrated an intention to grapple our boat. Perhaps others would have arrived soon after to augment the effort. Or perhaps I was being charitable where no such assumption was merited. Perhaps, if I had not fired that barb, one of us would have lost an eye or a hand to that grapple. Who was I to decide what was a weapon and what was a tool? "Ahead," Glass called, snapping me from my thoughts. "The lagoon. We've reached it." The channel widened, disclosing an area of relatively open water about 200 meters across. Walls of green surrounded the lagoon, at least as tall as any part of the channel, and beyond these walls rose ever higher terraces of dense green, climbing in ziggurat-like steps until they were at least 50 or 60 meters above the level of the sea. Some immense architecture of living matter must have supported these prominences, scaffolding them like the interlocking limbs of a forest canopy, but all complexities were hidden beneath the green mantle. The air was still, humid and heavy. The only way in or out of the lagoon was the channel that had brought us, and now that we had passed it, that aperture looked narrower, less navigable. The weather system that we had glimpsed over the node from a distance was now a dark, squatting mass directly above us. The clouds were moving in a restless, slithering, cross-hatched formation, like a nest of eels. No rain yet fell on us, but my skin prickled as if there was an ocean of water suspended over us by the thinnest of threads. Thunder rumbled some way off. A tick-like creature nipped my neck and I swatted it away. The boat had reached the middle of the lagoon. I arrested its drift with the oar, which I then set down in the bottom. "So," I said, addressing Glass, "we've arrived. This is the lagoon, or a lagoon. Do you have a script for the next part?"
"We commune," Glass said. "The node has permitted us passage, and the presence of this lagoon indicates a tacit invitation to proceed. We shall swim. You with the intention of contacting your brother, me to be restored to my earlier template.
Nothing big, then.
The jugglers rarely do anything in small ways."
Glass began to disrobe.
"Take off your clothes, Clavain. They'd only be consumed by the water, so if you want them afterwards, you'd better leave them on the boat."
"Naked humans," Pinky said with a faint, disgusted shudder. "You've no idea how much you look like pigs under all those layers. It's unsettling."
"Be glad you're not expected to swim," I said, beginning to strip off.
"I would if my life depended on it, which it would have to, because any other time swimming's almost certainly going to get me killed. You're sure you don't want to slow down a bit? You know, take in the scenery."
I nodded. "Every sane part of me, Scorp. But Glass is right. We're here now. No amount of delay is going to make any difference, and since I very, very badly want to be on the other side of this, then I'll just sit here and think happy thoughts."
"No," I said firmly. "You're still my advocate, remember? You don't have to swim. But if the node's aware of us, it's aware of you.
Start telling it that I'm not here to do any harm, and that it would be very good to meet my brother. Remind him who you are, and that you're here to vouch for me. At least there's nothing awkward about any of that. Do what you can. But above all else, no matter what happens here, you protect yourself. And if Glass and I don't return, you turn that boat around and return to first camp. You know that ain't happening, but nice sentiment. You'll give us 6 hours from the point where you lose contact with us, Glass said firmly. No longer. Your bravado doesn't concern me, but I'd like knowledge of our failure to make it back to Probably Rose. How will that help? I asked. They'll know what not to do. They'll have to try, nonetheless. If we don't succeed, they must, even though the odds decrease with each degree of separation from your brother. This is all we have, Clavaine. We either reach the knowledge held by Neville, or we fail, eternally. I finished undressing. Although the air was sticky and the storm felt as if it were building pressure, straining to burst through some incredibly thin membrane, I still shivered. I felt weak and cadaverous. Glass regarded me with clinical disinterest, and I nodded back at her, ready and not ready, full of wonder and terror and the deep apprehension that preceded any long-delayed family reunion. Into the water? Into the water. Glass slid off the boat, making a splashless entry into the lagoon. She submerged her whole body, then came back up with just her head and shoulders above the green surface. But now she was lathered in a fine marbling of green, and instead of wiping it from her eyes, she stared back with an unblinking ferocity of spirit. My advice is not to resist the organisms. Let them into you willingly, no matter how uncomfortable the process. Whatever will happen anyway, but resisting the contamination only delays the inevitable. I eased myself onto the edge of the boat, pinky counterbalancing it, then slipped into the lagoon, a couple of meters from Glass. I dipped my head under, closing my eyes by reflex, then pushed my face back into the air. My skin itched, and I had a strong sense of a gummy mass wanting to ooze its way into my nostrils. Glass paddled backwards from the boat, still keeping her head elevated from the water, with only her black-nailed fingers and toes breaking the surface. Follow me. We should put some distance between us and the boat. The node must recognize that our entry is deliberate and that we are not seeking to return to the boat's sanctuary. When will we know if something's happening? I doubt there will be much ambiguity. Your only clear memory of your last visit here was a sense of drowning. That should indicate the level of experience typical of juggler communion. I still had my face to the boat as I kicked alongside Glass. Pinky was standing up, astride the boat's middle, now that he no longer had to balance my weight. He puffed his chest, worked his shoulders, and cupped two hands around his snout. Hey, Neville, wondering if you can hear me? It's Scorp. You remember me, I guess. Hard not to, given how it went down the last time you and I were together. Part of me never thought I'd ever come back to this place. Part of me never wanted to. But here I am. Ain't life a surprise sometimes? He paused, shuddered, and seemed on the point of sitting down, overcome by the ridiculousness of the role I had placed on him. I would not have blamed him in the slightest. I had spoken truthfully when I said I wanted him to accompany me to the pattern jugglers, but only a small part of that had anything to do with his advocacy. I had come to regard him as a protector, a talisman, whose mere presence was enough to keep harm at bay. He had been at my brother's side until the end, and it was not through any failings of Pinky that Neville had perished. Yet after that deliberation, he regathered his purpose. You know I was never good at this stuff. After you were gone, they made me run this place. I guess I didn't do the worst job, all things told. Quite a lot of us made it, even if it wasn't exactly happy ever after once we got off Ararat. But the speech-making part of it? Never my finest hour. He tapped his forehead. They say there are things in here that aren't so well developed. Little circuits that help with reflection, strategic planning, delayed gratification, that kind of thing. And I suppose if those aren't working too well, then speaking out loud, being all persuasive and rhetorical, ain't likely to be my strongest suit either. But this little piggy is the last straw in the pack, so I guess we have to work with what we're given, and that's me. And I remember you, my friend. There hasn't been a day when I haven't brought you to mind. We were either together too long or not nearly enough. Ain't worked that one out just yet, and maybe I never will. But here's what I have to tell you. Pinky angled his head in my direction, giving me, what, forewarning? That my name and identity was about to be invoked, and once uttered, there could be no undoing it? I've brought someone to meet you. Maybe you already know who he is. I like to think you do, because then it takes the burden off me to do the introducing. But seeing as I was asked, and I don't like to let my friends down, this is your brother. His name is Warren, and I know there's some not-so-great stuff between you. Shit that went down hundreds of years ago. Shit you never told me about, probably because the wounds were still raw, even after all that time. Now, it ain't my job to say that none of that mattered, now or then, but I do have a duty to state my feelings. Warren doesn't measure up to you, Neville. He hasn't seen or done half the things, and I doubt he's known half the heartache you went through. But in the time I've known him, which I admit is just a scratch against a life, against a human life, leastwise, I've seen enough to make me say a good word for him. And if a word of this reaches you, and if any of it has any chance of you moving to accept him, even to speak to him in the way he wants, and open up about the things you still know, the things you might not even know matter to us, then I beg you to remember our friendship, and consider that any friend of mine must be a friend of yours, no matter how strange the course that brought us together. Pinky fell silent and buckled back down onto his haunches, worn out and perhaps aware that he had offered all that could reasonably be presented in my defence, and any further words were not likely to make any difference. By the time he finished, Glass and I had paddled most of the way across the lagoon, and with the green biomass forcing its way into me with each breath, stifling my breathing, it was all I could do to nod a grateful thanks for his intercession. It might not help, but it was all I could have hoped for, and I was very glad indeed that he had accompanied us. Are you frightened, Glass? Would it help if I am? I'm frightened, but I think my fears of a different kind than yours. This is either going to kill me or not. If it doesn't kill me, then I think I may come away with something of Neville, something that can help us. If I die, then nothing ever matters again. But you're expecting to lose part of yourself. Every new experience since you were last on Ararat. The jugglers might preserve something of your memories since then, but there's no guarantee of that.
It's an acceptable sacrifice.
And there's no guarantee that they will reset me to my earlier condition. There are informational structures in my brain that they may find enticing, sufficient to grant a favor. But a request does not have to be honored. Then you're between two hard places, dying in pieces here, or dying for good, a little while from now. I don't envy you, Glass, but if you won't admit that this is a little terrifying, I'll do it for you. I don't want to lose the part of you that's known me. You've been a witness and a catalyst to my changes. Whatever's become of me, whatever man I've now become, you were the instrument that made it happen. I won't say I'm grateful, although perhaps I should be. The truth is always better than the lie.
You do not need me to tell you what you are,
but I need you to hold these threads together. You're the only one who saw what I was and what I've become. You're half my story. If you crumble away, I don't know what will happen to the rest of me.
You were a survivor. You'll stay a survivor.
Here's my promise to you, Glass. If either of us comes out of this, and you've been reset, I'll help you recover the things you've lost. We'll be each other's crutches, two broken souls that can't exist without each other. I'll help you remember, and in remembering, you'll help me find myself. Glass considered my words, then said,
Can I tell you something, Clavaine? You talk too much.
The sky over us crackled. Around the lagoon, the green walls and terraces shimmered with faces, a constant dance of them. Now the faces were larger than before, house-sized visages leering at us, forming and collapsing back into the green substrate almost quicker than the eye could follow. It was more than just faces, too. Less familiar forms were appearing in the endless, overlapping confusion of solid images. Now alien bodies and body parts interposed themselves between the faces, interlocking like clever wallpaper designs. Claws, tentacles, compound eyes and scissoring wings among them. The waves of change hastened. The forms were blurring into a continuum, an infinite, disarticulated carnival of all the creatures that had ever touched this sea, and perhaps all the monsters and phantasms they ferried with them in their deepest nightmares and phobias. The waves of change, now a furious, flickering tumult, had begun to agitate the water of the lagoon. Disturbances sloshed from side to side, lifting us on one swell, crashing us down on the next. The rising and sinking waves brought the boat in and out of view. For a moment, I thought that Pinky had been knocked overboard, but on the next glimpse I was relieved to see him pressed to the cross-planks, presenting as low a center of gravity as possible. I feared for him, but as long as the boat stayed upright, I thought he had a chance. Glass was still close to me, but the force of the water's movement was starting to push us apart. Even as I gave all of myself to the act of swimming, holding my head above the surging green swell, I tried to reach out to her. My fingers closed on something, but not firmly enough. I paddled, snorted green muck from my nose, and struck out again. But Glass was out of reach, and now the airborne haze was blurring my vision. All was turning green. Glass! I called out, with one good breath. Glass! But Glass was gone. I fought it for a little while, even as I knew that the wisest course was to submit, to allow the green into my lungs, to drown so that I might be reborn. But 500 million years of land-based evolution had wired my brain with a powerful aversion to the notion of drowning. It was not the same as getting into one of the acceleration tanks on Scythe, surrounded by all the reassurances of modern civilization. I was alone now, devoid of tools or protection, naked to the core, just a small, frightened mammal about to drown, and all my higher faculties turned and fled in the face of that most primal of fears. So I fought and fought, but always with ebbing strength, until at last I had nothing more to give, and the green tide flooded into me with eager enthusiasm. Citadel gates at last flung wide to the besieging army. The organism stormed my throat, my windpipe, my lungs. They fissured through me like a green lava flow, finding every crevice and channel to every other part of me. They followed nerves and blood vessels, infiltrating my brain, establishing lines of communication out of my body and into the wider node, and from there to every other node on Ararat. There was a point of maximum terror, then submission, then a dawning acceptance. Then the green bliss of dissolution. Even as my sense of self evaporated, I lost sight of why it had ever mattered in the first place. The sea was old and warm and welcoming. I was just another set of patterns to be folded into the whole. I remembered Glass and Pinky, and that I had come here for a reason. The urgency of my mission had not deserted me. But now it was just one imperative fighting for attention against a welter of new impulses and sensations. Because I knew that it mattered, I held on to it with what felt like a superhuman effort of will. My brother. I had to sift through the impressions battering my mind and identify his distinct presence, then reach out to it with all the humility and submission I could muster. Memory stroked my consciousness, bursting against its limits. They were not mine. They were not, for the most part, anything that I would have called human. I saw alien skies, alien suns, birthing nebulae, the scattered ashes of worlds and stars, vistas of great magnificence and equally great desolation. Time dizzied me. I had thought I understood time, but now my ignorance left me reeling. Time was vaster and colder and lonelier than anything I had ever imagined. There had already been so much of it. Heavy oceanic layers of time, plunging into deep, still blackness, and my consciousness was just a feeble thing drifting in the highest sunlit layer. A galaxy's worth of history had already passed into this ocean and been memorialized. All our human adventuring was no more than a scuff on the final page, unwarranted, barely noticed. I retained some sense of my physical embodiment. I had been blurred at the edges, but not destroyed. Something resembling a man was still immersed in the lagoon, although now I was no longer swimming, no longer breathing air. I was a man-shaped density gradient in the green slurry, a concentration of living matter that could be dispersed or reconsolidated with equal disregard. I formed a thought. Help, glass. And another, don't hurt Scorp. The lagoon's movement had become a bottled storm. I was in it somewhere, tethered to the node like a billion-stringed puppet. I rose and fell on the surges. By some means I remained aware of my surroundings, even as I no longer had a clear sense of my own point of view. Encircling the lagoon, the play of forms had become a frenzy of transformation. Lights lit the flickering, ever-shifting mass. Sprites cross-knit the air. Purple clouds bellied down. Lightning arced between the node and the sky, over and over, some monstrous circuitry completing itself. A form began to bud from the lagoon side, maintaining integrity against the changing background. It was a rounded protrusion, a green stump gradually extending itself, as if it meant to form an arcing connection from one side of the lagoon to the other. The stump ceased its projection. It began to reshape itself, the green slurry flowing and reorganizing in deliberate waves. The stump was becoming five-budded. The buds were becoming distinct in form and size. Four were fingers. One was a thumb. The green hand reached down from the sky and plucked me from the lagoon. It pinched me between its fingers and I saw myself as it did, a straggly, fibrous starfish, dripping tendrils. The hand lifted me higher. Now the point where it emerged from the lagoon's wall was gaining definition and stability, becoming a lumpy, towering torso. Another arm began to bud from the torso, then a boulder-like head. Two trunk-like columns differentiated themselves and lifted the torso and head ever higher. The hand elevated me until I was level with the head. It was crudely carved, lopsided. There had been a face there once, but now it was time-eroded, ruined, blasted by eternity. All that remained were suggestive creases and folds. Two eye-holes, the crease of a mouth, the line of a beard. And still I knew it. I formed his name. Neville. 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 And the face spoke into me. How dare you call me that? How dare you use my name? I felt the hand's embrace around my soggy, sagging body. The hand and I were made of the same matter, intertangling and interpenetrating. You know mine. I'm Warren, your brother. The fingers squeezed tighter. You shouldn't have come back. Didn't you remember what I promised? Didn't I make it clear what I'd do to you if you returned? The face was gaining depth and symmetry, becoming a mirror to my own. Ageless eyes of blank green formed beneath the overhang of massive brows. I need your help, Neville. We all need your help. The face formed a sneer. Isn't it enough that I already died for you once? Your friends are here. They know they can't ask more of you. But there's something you know, a piece of information you've carried with you that will help us. Help us all, Neville. Help humanity, or that's left of it. The lips defined a mirthless smile. And for theirs, they send you. If there were a part of me still breathing, a ribcage, lungs, and heart within that green concentration, I forced myself to take two slow, measured breaths.
No, I sent myself.
Then you forget our last meeting, the one where I nearly killed you and left you with that as a warning never to trouble these seas again. The head cocked, quizzically. I thought I was clear. What part of that wasn't clear?
You left a part of you within me last time. I came with a hyper pig called Pinky. Only I called him Scorp once. And the only way that I could have known that name is because you left it with me the last time I was here.
Scorp spoke for me. If anything that he said reached you, then you'll know that I am not here to cause you hurt or to seek forgiveness. He knows me better than I know myself. And he knew you.
The hand tightened.
You've tricked my old friend.
No, I haven't tricked him.
I tricked myself. I blocked my memories and made a new life for myself to escape the truth of what I am and what I did to you. I deny none of that, and I'm ready to pay whatever price you deem necessary for returning here. But before you punish me, we must have the information. You owe that to Scorp, to Anakuri, to all the dead of Ararat, to the memories of Felka and Galiana. It was a risk to invoke those who had been dear to him, and I was willing to take it. With that invocation, I knew that I would either breach his defenses or turn him fully against me. There could be no middle ground. The hand squeezed tighter and tighter still. I felt myself oozing out between his fingers, a loosening slurry that had once been a man called Warren Clavaine, and still the hand kept squeezing. Chapter 27. Our suits guided our return to the musky shelter, backtracking via inertial compasses. The storm was abating as we moved into the cover of the camouflaging awning. If they take the bait, I said, when we were unpacking the equipment again and enjoying sips through our nutrient straws, it will be sooner rather than later.
Is there a chance they'll just let them die? Charity asked. Isn't that the most likely outcome, given what we know of the group mind psychology?
There have been numerous cases of individuals or groups being sacrificed to offset a risk to the main nests.
It's true. I nodded. But these are raw recruits who ran the gauntlet to get to Mars. The other conjoiners won't want to do anything that might deter similar ventures. The mother nests need fresh bodies to replace those we kill. Even if it is only a question of not handing us a propaganda coup, they'll be strongly disinclined to abandon these fresh young puppies.
I don't understand how they think, Charity said. After all my time in psychosurgical ops, I understand what goes on inside their heads, probably better than anyone, but I still don't have a sense of how it would feel to be a conjoiner.
Be glad, Hope said. It feels marvelous, I said, removing the cartridge from my semi-automatic and slipping in a replacement. It must feel marvelous, or they'd try to undo it. That, or it's a trick of memory. It might feel terrible in absolute terms, but if the subject's tricked into believing that it's still better than what they had before, they'll accept the transformation unquestioningly. Accept it, and not want it taken away from them.
Your brother's given this a lot of thought, Hope said.
I caught Charity's frown.
Whose brother? She must be thinking.
She had no brother. Was the statement meant for me? But none of us were supposed to know about our respective backgrounds, not even so much as our real names, let alone familial relationships.
Something about the casual way Hope had made the observation had undoubtedly left Charity discomforted, feeling on the outside of something. I empathized. It was a familiar, skin-prickling sensation.
I doubt anyone's given it more thought, I said, clicking the magazine back into the handle of the semi-automatic. My brother might even get to see what the process feels like for himself.
Your brother? Charity asked. The prisoner, our extraction objective, the man we've come to Mars to steal away from the spiders.
I didn't know.
You weren't meant to know, I answered, not without some kindness. Anyway, it's not tactically relevant. All that matters is that he's a high-value asset that we'd like back for ourselves, and now we're a step closer to getting him home.
Are you Sky Marshal Clavaine, sir?
I wondered if she detected some distant, merciless amusement in my answer. Would you think it likely, Charity?
I don't know.
She swallowed hard. I thought that the Sky Marshal, one of the Marshals I mean, was on a diplomatic mission to Europa. I answered her patiently. Sky Marshal Neville Clavaine has been on Mars for 3.5 months, Charity. That whole story about Europa was a smokescreen to explain his absence. It's embarrassing to us that he's been taken, even more embarrassing that we haven't yet got him back. But we're close now, thanks to you.
Then you must be Sky Marshal Warren Clavaine, sir.
I must.
I am honored to be part of this operation, sir.
I always took it seriously, but now that I know the prisoner's identity and that you're with us. Let me turn this around, Charity, I said, interrupting her gently. She would still keep thinking of me as Faith until I gave her permission to use my actual name and rank. Things have gone well so far, almost exactly according to plan, apart from one detail. A salty wind snapped against my cheeks. I was sitting on my haunches, knees drawn up, arms wrapped around grazed shins, pale grass tickling my calves, shivering. Another boy sat next to me. Beyond us was a sloping shoreline of grass, hemming a thin strand of colourless mud, and beyond it a seething grey sea, rows of white caps stretching unbroken to a horizon the colour of digital static.
Did you really think this was a good idea?
The other boy said, rolling a smooth grey pebble between his fingers.
I mean, after everything, I had no choice.
If our roles had been reversed, you'd have come back to Ararat just as I did. The wind flicked my hair against my eyes. I brushed it away, squinting irritatedly.
This isn't about what I did to you, or what you said you'd do to me, isn't it?
I know that I wronged you, set you up to die for the sake of a political stunt, because I desired the continuation of the war rather than the peace you knew was possible.
That was wrong, I know,
but it wasn't because I loved war itself. It was because I believed in our cause, and I thought war was the only way for it to prevail.
So you wronged me, but it was all right because you believed in a higher cause.
I ground my teeth.
Not what I'm saying. Let's be clear about the nature of your betrayal, shall we? You didn't just set up my peace initiative to fail. You arranged for me to stumble into a lethal trap. You plotted my murder. You didn't die, which must have been a weight off your conscience.
You gave as good as you got, I said, casting my eyes to the slate-coloured indeterminacy of the horizon. When you turned your loyalties over to Galliana and fled the solar system, what was the last message you sent back to the world? One of high-minded forgiveness, befitting one who has finally risen above the pettiness of war. I sniffed, shaking my head slowly.
No.
You reserved all your energies to announce a brotherly vendetta. You said that you'd kill me if you ever got the chance, and that you'd never revoke that promise. That no deed on my part could ever atone for my one crime against you. That I shouldn't even attempt to live a better life, because it was mathematically impossible to ever earn your forgiveness.
And yet, you live.
For now.
Did it occur to you that I might not want to be found on Ararat?
After a silence, I said,
I was here before.
I tried and failed, but for some reason, you left me alive.
You remembered?
I remembered the terror of drowning. I remembered that I didn't want to return to this place, even if I didn't quite know why.
You should have listened to your fears. Perhaps in a moment of weakness, I pitied you enough not to kill you there and then.
But those fears should have made it very clear that I was serious about what would happen the next time.
And yet, here we are.
I reached down, uprooting a clump of grass with a nub of muddy soil at the end of it.
I haven't come back to test the seriousness of your threat. I'm not here to seek atonement or persuade you that I deserve another chance. I'm not even here as a brother. I'm here to speak to you as one soldier to another, about a war that makes the one that divided us seem ludicrous and tiny. I'm talking about extinction, something which makes our lives look about as significant as this piece of dirt compared to that ocean.
He reflected on an answer, then said testily,
"It's not an ocean. It's the North Sea." "You saw something,"
I persisted, "in your explorations, when you and Galliana took the Sandravoy off into interstellar space, forging beyond any of the systems that had already been mapped and explored, skimming close to a gas giant. Your instruments picked up the signature of something that didn't belong, a physical anomaly deep within the planet's atmosphere. It was far too deep for your ship to reach, and your sturdiest probes only got close enough to glimpse its presence. You could get no nearer, so you did the only sensible thing. Filed the anomaly away for future reference. A puzzle to be explored when conjoined science had advanced by a couple more centuries."
I tossed aside the clump of grass. "But that advancement never came. History got in the way. The anomaly remained a footnote, too far away and too speculative to be worth the investment of a return expedition. Perhaps it was a mirage after all. A data ghost, or the result of some clever little trick of natural science, like a Brocken spectre. Interesting in its own right, but not likely to win a war."
I paused. "But you were thinking about the wrong war."
"Wars used to occupy me,"
Neville said, sighing.
"Now they don't. Being here, being what I am in the green becoming, you'd be surprised how my perspectives have changed. I was weary of it all near the end. Now I'm so far past the point of weariness you wouldn't even recognize my state of mind." "I'm weary too,"
I admitted.
"We've both been through it."
He gave a small chuckle.
"Through the wars, literally. But this is different. Those old wars were the result of human failings. We made them happen because we were too lazy to think our way to something better. We could have walked away at any point, but not this one."
He turned to me with a wry amusement, crinkling the corners of his eyes, the lines of a man rather than a boy.
"You think such a distinction matters to me now? It had better. The sanctuary that you found here may not be as permanent as you imagine. The wolves won't touch these waters. I wondered if you remembered what brought you here. Hard to forget. Then put your faith in the wolves, if you wish. Maybe there's an instruction in their deep programming to avoid harming juggler planets. Maybe that's held in the past. But do you have absolute confidence that it still holds true across all space and time? The wolves are still dangerous. We've seen ample evidence of that. But the fact that we got as far into space as we did, and for as long, shows that they're not as efficient as they used to be. Things have been going wrong inside them for millions of years. Slow failings. Entropic breakdown. All systems succumb in the end. Even ruthless machine ones. With that breakdown, all manner of programmed boundaries might become blurred. That's supposition. Perhaps. But you can't deny that damage has already been done to Ararat. The shattering of the moon. The infall of the debris. The enhanced volcanism and tectonic activity following that cataclysm. The seas have risen. Islands been swallowed up. The sea will heal. You underestimate its resilience. But I don't underestimate your instinct for caution. There's a seed of doubt there, Neville. Don't deny it.
He was silent for at least a minute. The waves crashed. The grasses swayed. The sky was the same grey as the sea. The wind relentless.
You say you came with Scorp?
I did.
I didn't sense his presence. He's here. Or there. In the lagoon. We came with Glass.
Are you aware of Glass?
There was another.
This wasn't her first time. I nodded, eagerly.
She came here looking for you, just as I did. I was rebuffed, and so was Glass. Do you remember something of her?
I looked inside her head.
Now or then? The first time. She wasn't aware.
He chuckled, amused by himself. I picked her apart like a fruit. Studied what little was interesting. Reassembled her.
Do you know who she is, Warren?
Have you worked it out yet?
Glass isn't the puzzle I came to solve.
Well, we don't always get to choose.
She was with you on Mars. That's how far back her memories go. She was there. Part of the extraction team. You remember, don't you? You came to rescue me.
No.
You don't remember?
No.
I do remember.
But Glass couldn't have been part of that.
It's not possible. We left her for dead.
You mean after you killed her?
My next question left Charity at something of a loss. What planet would you say we're on? But for her nervousness, I think she might almost have laughed at the absurdity of my inquiry. I was being deliberately cruel. I was not normally cruel. Ruthless, single-minded, yes. But now that the opportunity was here, I found that I felt comfortable with cruelty. Comfortable and more than a little regretful that I had not tried it sooner. It was like a garment that turned out to suit me more than I had expected it could. A surprise and a delight.
This is Mars, sir.
We're on Mars. Can you be sure that this is Mars and not a simulation? I caught her hesitation.
It's not a simulation, sir.
I've been through the training simulations. All of us in psychosurgical ops have. And they're good. Very good. But I'm certain that this is a real operation, happening in real time, and that we're really on Mars.
Well, you're right about that.
Thank you, sir.
Next question. Is there air on Mars?
No, sir. I mean, almost none.
There's barely any atmosphere, and what there is isn't breathable. I know there's thicker, warmer air inside the Great Wall, but it's building up slowly, and what there is...
Charity faltered.
What there is isn't really breathable yet. No one can survive anywhere on Mars, outside the pressurized compounds or capsules, unless they're in a suit.
Well, there's the number vent.
Hope made a quiet chuckling sound.
There it is.
Suits are the problem, you see. If the extraction goes as planned, and thanks to your excellent work, Charity, there's no reason it won't, we've still got to get our prisoner, my brother, out of that camp and off the surface of Mars. Hope put in, what would come in handy, do you think?
A suit, sir. Sirs.
It most certainly will, I said. When we were younger and used to go swimming in the loch near our home, my brother and I would sometimes play a game to see who could hold their breath underwater the longest. I dropped my voice to a confiding register. I have to tell you that Neville always won. He had far better lungs than me, or far better willpower. I'm not sure which. But even Neville couldn't hold his breath long enough to get off Mars.
Perhaps the conjoiners will have been kind enough to leave one nearby, Hope said, pre-tanked and ready for just such an escape attempt. What do you think, Charity?
I don't think they'd be likely to do that, sir.
Nor do I agreed. We could try and take one of their own suits off them, of course, but that won't be much good if we're in a hurry. Those suits aren't like anything we use.
Neurally linked to the occupants, Hope said, nodding in agreement with me.
No conventional controls at all. If we had a day or so, we could patch in our own control harness, but the one thing we won't have is time. We have to get in and out very quickly. But you know that.
I do,
Charity said.
It's why a fourth suit came with us. The one that didn't make it down. You said there'd be a workaround, sir.
You're the workaround, I answered. Charity became emboldened.
My mission deliverable lies in the administering of the neural protocols. I am an expert in that field.
I was trained to deliver that element of the operation, and I did. I did what I was meant to do. The rest is not my responsibility.
And rest assured that we will always be indebted to you, I said. Quickly, smoothly, I aimed the pistol and shot her through her visor. Air geysered out through the hole in the glass until Hope jammed his finger into the hole, giving me time to turn off the life support valves and prevent further loss of closed cycle pressure. The flow was reversed and the remaining air sucked back into the reservoir, allowing the suit to be dismantled and removed from Charity and then reassembled as an empty unit. Hope confirmed that the damage to the back of the helmet was minimal. The bullet had not broken through. The old visor was swapped for the new one, a simple field procedure that we had rehearsed until our fingers could do it blind. It was good that we had brought spares.
I hope she was right about those protocols being self-adaptive, Hope commented as we peeled back the mat and dug out a shallow grave.
I don't doubt for a minute that she did everything asked of her, I answered. I meant what I told her. We're indebted. When all this is behind us, she'll get her due recognition. She deserves nothing less. While we worked to bury the rapidly freezing corpse, I reflected on what had been required of me. If and when the operation was declassified, there would be no lie about what had happened here. The facts would be presented exactly as they were. I had shot one of our own, for the sake of the mission. It would not be passed off as an accident or the result of enemy fire. It was cold-blooded, on some level quite indefensible, murder. But there was, in my view, no moral distinction between my killing Charity and a military planner sending a group of soldiers into battle, knowing that a third of them were bound to die. It was just what had to be done.
I wonder why she didn't say something when I put that visor down, Hope said.
She was task-orientated. She lacked overview. Inside my helmet, I smiled once. There's no shame in that. We'll need both mindsets to win this war.
I hope I've got the right one.
I hope both of us have. We completed the burial. After that, it was only a question of waiting. The storm had passed and the skies over the shelter were clear and cloudless. Hope and I had no knowledge of the weather conditions outside of our immediate locality, nor could any information be communicated to us, but it seemed likely that the clear conditions extended all the way to the defection capsule, now exposed again after the storm. The storm had been our ally in two aspects, providing cover for our approach and retreat, but also blasting the ground after us, scouring away any traces we left. Still, there would only need to be one lingering hand or stilt print to alert the conjoiners that someone had been at the capsule, and I was in no doubt at all that they would be looking for signs of interference. Equally, I was sure the prize would be too tempting for them to ignore. I shook my head. No, we would never have done that.
Of course we would, brother. It was war.
He stared out to sea, lost in the past.
The Coalition for Neural Purity. Doesn't that suggest a certain self-righteous certainty of purpose? And you and I, what part of that were we? The Knights of Cydonia? Masters of War? Masters of Mars? We did whatever was needed. Murdering one of our own, even a brilliant, loyal, and courageous volunteer, because she needed to die for me to survive? Not a moment's hesitation. If I killed Charity, and this time I stopped short of absolute denial, remembering Glass's insistence that I had already murdered her once. No, if. Would you like to see it, brother? Would you like to remember properly what it was you did?
No,
I began to reply. The trouble is, I think you're quite a way past the point of getting to have that choice. He added helpfully, let me reach into you a little further. Let me strip away the last of those mental blockades so that you can finally know yourself.
Neville, please.
He laughed aside my pleading. I felt him delving into my soul, flicking aside my feeble screens and blinds, shredding and discarding them like the thin disposable phantasms of self-denial they had been. Until Charity came back to me, her face behind the visor, the snapping trapdoor logic of that moment, the cold, clear realization of what I was about to do to her. The merest distress in her eyes, the tiniest bend to her mouth, as she began to frame a counter-argument, a new plan for our consideration. The squeeze of my finger on the trigger, the release, the recoil, the bullet's gyring trajectory, barrel to thin vacuum to visor glass, the visor puncturing as the bullet spun through it, the shards of glass, the bullet's continuation, into air, moist and warm, even as it sucked itself out into the pitiful atmosphere of Mars, its progress into the first part of her face, into skin, into the flesh beneath her skin, into muscle and bone and frontal cortex. Her mouth still struggling to form a word, because nerve signals were still reaching her larynx. He looped the memory, made it play back over and again, slower and more horribly each time, until he had eroded me to a sobbing core, a moral remnant that finally understood what it had done to another human being. Finally understood, finally knew. How did she come back? He answered matter-of-factly. The conjoiners found her eventually, brought her corpse into the nest and took it upon themselves to see what could be salvaged of her. A kind of pet project, an internally run conjoiner experiment in radical neural reconstruction. Think of the benefits. If they could bring her back to life after days of exposure, after no end of damage to her brain, then the same principles of memory and personality reconstruction could be applied to their own wounded. It doesn't sound all that different to what they did to those of ours they took prisoner. Dragged them to the recruitment theatres, opened up their skulls, stuffed conjoiner machinery into their heads. Instant conversion to the cause. I paused. But Glass isn't one of them. She has all the gifts of the conjoined, but she acts alone. That was another aspect of the experiment. Being conjoined gave them strength in numbers. Gave us, I should say. I nodded, reminded of my brother's ultimate defection to Galliana's movement. But like you, Glass was not quite one of them. In my case, I made a deliberate decision not to commit to full trans-enlightenment. I thought I could be more useful, more agile, if I retained a degree of neural autonomy. So it proved, I think. That same autonomy was imposed on Glass by design, from the outset, and made more extreme. It would be an exaggeration to say that she was given engineered sociopathy, but also not entirely divorced from the facts. What were they hoping to achieve? Insurance, I suppose. One loyal to their cause, our cause, but who could act independently, far from the mental support of other conjoiners. A lone agent, sent out into the world. Doubtless there were others, but perhaps only Glass has come to us across the centuries. I reflected on his words, picking up sand and allowing it to trickle through my fingers. I wondered if the grains were sufficient to count the years that Glass had been travelling. When she found me on Michaelmas, I thought her only interest in me was as a means of defeating the wolves. But that was only half of it. The rest of it was punishment. She knew what I had done, and she required me to remember it too. You think of this as punishment? Isn't the truth supposed to set us free? I looked down, my eyes stung by the wind. I was a good man on Michaelmas. You were a lie. Now you have to live with what you are, not with some comforting fiction. Neville shifted, as if he was getting cramp from sitting in the same position. I'll tell you what. Are you really serious about wanting the name of that world? We need the location, the identity of the ice giant Glass called Charybdis. Scythe, the ship we came in, has the means to reach whatever you saw inside that atmosphere.
To what purpose?
Glass believes you saw a nest builder vehicle. We know they exist. You saw the relics littering this planet.
Relics don't bode well.
Glass's intelligence suggests that the nest builders are the only species within this sector of the galaxy to have attained any sort of technological parity with the inhibitors.
Then why haven't they wiped them out already?
It seems they prefer a strategy of managed containment. They have a stick that can poke the wolves, but if they use it too many times, the wolves will evolve a countermeasure. So for the nest builders, the best approach is to survive by stealth and only use their weaponry as a last resort, even if that means accepting the occasional defeat. Think of the weapon as a supremely powerful antibiotic, to be used only in direst need, lest the bacteria develop resistance.
And the name of this weapon?
An incantor. That's Glass's translation, the nearest approximation in human terms.
And your aim is what?
To extract the incantor from this wreck? Better than that, to harvest the information that lets us make our own incantor, using hypermetric technology as an intermediary step. Once we've made one, we can make others.
Ambitious.
There is no other course.
Doesn't it concern you that the nest builders won't take kindly to this misuse of their technology?
They shouldn't have been careless with their secrets in the first place. We won't use it indiscriminately, but if it's a choice between extinction tomorrow and incurring the wrath of the nest builders, I'll take the wrath. If all we do is push the wolves back out from this corner of space, we'll still have bought time. Besides, Glass told me something else. Never looked at me with the first real interest since the start of our meeting.
Oh?
There's something that helps us. Some leverage. Something she knows that could work to our advantage when it comes to securing the incantor.
A bargaining ploy.
I shifted, uncomfortable with my ignorance. Something like that.
Glass knows a lot about these nest builders. A strange amount, considering how sparse our own knowledge base was at the time of my demise. Almost everything, apart from that location.
Glass only tells me what she needs to, and then only under duress. Will you help us? Neville deliberated. I wondered how much of that was real, and how much was for no other reason than to torment me. This had never occurred to me, that I might reach him, but not make a persuasive enough case.
How did you take to Scorp?
I sifted through the possible answers I might offer, finally settling on the truth. Not well, to begin with.
An aversion to pigs.
An aversion to his having an aversion to me. He didn't believe any part of the story he was presented with. Certainly didn't believe I could ever be half the man you'd been. He made no secret of the fact he considered me unworthy of his friendship.
Yet by some means you've turned him around.
I put my life on the line. He was ready to put himself forward for a slow, painful death. I wouldn't let him face that alone, or without an escape plan. We made it out and obtained the technology that Scythe needed to reach the nest builder vessel.
You think that made him your friend?
I shook my head. No. I wouldn't be so callow as to imagine his opinion could be altered by a single deed. But it was the start of something. I know I'll never be your equal in his eyes, but I think he's accepted that I'm not an impostor.
I should have liked to have spoken to Scorp again, to have thanked him for being there, at the end, to have wished him well, and listened to his voice again. He was a better man than any of us.
Let me be the one to pass on that message.
Do you think you'd be up to it?
I wronged you very badly in ways that can't ever be undone. But I can start to become the better human being I always believed I was on Michaelmas. Let me carry your friendship back to Pinky.
There's a small problem with that.
He began to rise, pushing himself up by his knees.
I made you a promise, Warren. I said that if you ever came back here, I'd kill you. Now, if a man breaks his word...
I rose as well,
the cold seeping into my spine. I had allowed myself to believe I was getting somewhere with him, that there might be a way to convince him.
Neville, put aside what's happened between us. Humanity matters more than a couple of feuding brothers. Give me the information. Once we have the Encantor, I'll return here. You can do as you will with me, but allow me this stay of execution. And if that isn't acceptable to you, find a way to pass the information directly to Glass.
I still don't know that you really came with Scorp. Why should I trust your word? The inhibitors got into others. They could have got into you, or Glass, or anyone. You might want that information so you can finally destroy any chance of the Encantor falling into human hands.
It's not that, I pleaded.
Then prove it. The last thing I said, out of those that survived that day, only Scorp was there. Only he knew. He'd remember, and if he meant me to trust you, he'd have told you that word.
A quiet anger rose in me. I was wearying of these brotherly games.
You may have become the better man, Neville, but you were always a monster to me. Nothing's changed.
So you don't know.
I shook my head, sneering.
These sands? That sea? That grey, dreary sky?
I always knew where we were, you stupid fool.
This is Scotland, where we were born, where we grew up. The word is Scotland.
Two figures appeared from the mist behind us. They were indistinct, grey silhouettes. But I thought that one was an older woman and one a younger, and the two of them gestured for Neville Clavaine to turn from the iron sea.
Scotland,
I repeated more softly. Neville nodded. Without seeming to change, some trick of perception being worked on the deep architecture of my brain, the boy became a man, and the man became very old. His eyes were infinitely cold, infinitely patient, and infinitely sorrowful. He had seen and endured more than any soul should.
"You'll remember what needs to be remembered,"
he said, and turned to rejoin Galliana and Felka. I came up for air and gasped the first sweet, life-giving breath into my lungs. I was alive. I had been spared. And although I could not momentarily bring it to mind, I knew that there was a piece of knowledge inside me which had not been there before, and which I would soon be able to express. I wiped green scum from my eyes and trod water, breathing heavily, pleased not to be dead, but not sure that I had the strength to keep myself from drowning. I looked around through stinging, watery eyes, squinting into the trembling light. The lagoon's green walls had passed away. I could see nothing of the node, and nothing of the weather system. With no other reference points, it was impossible to say which of us had moved. I could not allow myself to die out here, but my limbs felt heavy and my muscles nearly empty of strength. How absurd it would be to have succeeded in my mission with Neville, then to perish before ever communicating the information to my allies. But that was exactly the kind of sick joke the universe had no qualms about playing on its inhabitants. No, I vowed, not here, not now. I was going to live. While I had the energy to hold a conscious thought, I had the energy to swim, or at least keep myself afloat. Something glinted at the edge of my vision. It came and went, bobbing on the waves, snatched in and out of view. The boat. If I could see it at all, it had to be near, but in that moment nothing had ever seemed so distant. A wave slapped me and I took in a mouthful of water. I coughed it out, spluttering, but not quickly enough to stop some going down my windpipe. A velvety darkness lapped at the edge of my thoughts. The boat was gone, and I wondered if I had imagined it. Then it was back again. I fixed its position against a pattern of clouds, hoping neither the boat nor the clouds would move against each other too swiftly, and struck out in that direction. My swimming was so feeble that any current would have negated it completely. But the boat did not seem to be moving, so I hoped that any movement of the waters would act on us equally. It had been a smudge of tin-coloured metal, identifiable as the boat, only because no other artificial thing could be anywhere near me. Now, at last, I could discern more of its details. I was hoping to see Pinky, perhaps not yet aware of me, but waiting. The boat was on its back. No wonder it had been so hard to see as it moved up and down on the swell. I stared at it in shock, unable to accept what I was seeing. Not after all this. Not this.
Scorp,
I mouthed, before spitting out water. In that moment I hated everything about this world. I hated the sea, the jugglers, the minds within them, the capricious and unforgiving tyrant that was my brother, and the uncaring will that had allowed this to happen. But since the boat was still my only point of sanctuary, and I retained enough of my own will not to want to drown, I kept swimming. Perhaps, as a mirage within a mirage, the boat would invert itself as I got nearer, and I would see my friend the pig beckoning me to close the distance. I swam and swam. The boat became more constant in its presence, but nothing about it changed. Like some demonstration of Zeno's paradox, my energy halved with each halving of the distance yet to swim. I was going to have to shatter some infinities to make it to that doubtful objective. How long it took me, I have no idea. In all likelihood, the entire interval between my coming up for air and touching the boat was no more than minutes in extent. But there was room in my struggle and despair for endless days. I stayed in the water for a long while, holding on to the boat but without the strength to do more than that. Intuition told me that I had no hope of turning the hull around again, but when I regained some tiny measure of strength in my limbs, I still tried it. The hull was much too heavy for a lone swimmer to tip over. Then I gathered a deep breath and poked my head under the water and up into the inverted hull, where there was still a pocket of air. I had very little hope of finding Pinky there, and he was absent. So was all of our equipment. No matter how carefully we thought it had been stowed, it had not survived the capsizing. The water was starting to feel cold. I could not survive immersion for very much longer. With one last exertion, I ducked out again, heaved myself up onto the boat's belly, hooking an ankle around the keel and stretching as far as I could until my fingers found one of the mounts for the oars. I dragged myself onto that baking metal, sprawled face down against it, content that if I had to die, then at least I would not give myself to the ocean. Then I lay in a fog of half-consciousness, broken and exhausted, and with too many impressions storming the edges of my thoughts for any one of them to gain precedence over the others. Somewhere in them was the realization that when my fingers scratched against the boat's side, they had been tipped with black. But there was not enough left of me to think deeply about that. There was sun and light, cold and sea spray. Straddling the boat, face down on the bobbing swell, living by the merest thread, I grew weaker rather than stronger. By the time they came, I had nothing to offer by way of resistance. They emerged from the waters, pressing webbed hands to the boat's flanks, studying me with those inscrutable, proud, whiskered faces that were half-human, half-seal. I think I screamed, or at least mouthed some failing protestation. But one of them pressed a finger to my lips as if silencing a child against the night's terrors, and by some strange persuasion I was moved to submission. Then they swept me into the darkening waters.